Great, perfect. Thanks, Steva. I'm really excited to be here for this workshop. Some of you know I did my PhD here in Santa Barbara, and so it's always great to be back, particularly in this context. And whenever I'm back here, I find it really impossible to ignore just how rich and detailed our sensory surroundings are. And our brain is capable of keeping track of these details with very fine precision. So as an example, if we walk out on the beach, it's possible to distinguish individual grains of sand. But keeping track of our sensory surroundings at this level of detail is incredibly expensive. And the brain has limited energy. And so for a long time, people have thought about how the brain could make efficient use of this limited energy by keeping track of those details that provide as much information as possible about our sensory surroundings. And this idea has been very useful for understanding different aspects of the structure and function of early sensory systems. So a very nice example comes from work by Simon Laughlin from the 80s, where he looked at the response properties of neurons in the early visual system of the blowfly. And these neurons respond to changes in light intensity, but they have finite dynamic range, which means it's not possible to respond equally well to all changes in light intensity. And so if you have a system with limited dynamic range, it pays to use this dynamic range to discriminate those signals that you're most likely to encounter in your surroundings. And Laughlin showed that this idea could be used to understand the response properties of these blowfly neurons. And he showed this by comparing the tuning curve, or the response curve of these neurons, to the distribution of light intensity that's found in nature. And he showed that the tuning curves of these neurons were aligned such that this region of highest discriminability here was aligned with the peak of this distribution. So these neurons devote sort of the sweet spot of their tuning curve to the signals that are most probable, most likely to occur in the environment. This means if you were to look at the responses of these neurons to very bright signals, it might be difficult to discriminate those responses. Or similarly, discriminate the responses to very, very dark signals. But right here in the middle, where you have the highest likelihood, you have high discriminability. Right, so Laughlin showed that these neurons had this particular property, but he went further to explain why this might be a good strategy. And so to do this, he approximated a continuous tuning curve by what he called a discrete set of response states. So you can think of these as discriminable firing rates. And he asked, if I have a neuron that can produce a small set of discriminable firing rates, how should that neuron use those firing rates to capture as much information as possible about the distribution of light? All right, so you can think of this problem in another way. You can ask, how should the neuron essentially divide up this probability distribution and assign it to different responses in order to get as much information as possible? And it turns out that the solution to that problem is to use all of your responses with equal probability. So a way to think about this is in terms of dividing up this distribution. So here I've assigned each chunk of this distribution a different color. And if we look at the area assigned to each of these colors, this corresponds to a different of these response states. And if we look at the probability that we measure each of these responses, we see that the histogram is flat. So we use each of these responses with equal likelihood.
You just maximize entropy.
This is maximizing entropy, right. So this is a solution to an infimax problem. And so what you get out of this is a maximum entropy distribution here, where you have probability distributed across your different response levels. All right, so this idea is a very general one. It's been very useful for understanding the response properties of neurons in a range of different sensory systems. But it doesn't help us understand how this information might be used to support different downstream computations and ultimately to support behavior. So another way to say this is if we go out on the beach and it's possible to see every grain of sand, but it's not really clear that that's useful. So to give you another example, if I show you a collection of image patches, the very fine details that differentiate these patches might be very useful for helping you determine that you're looking at tiger and not looking at grass. But once you know that this is a tiger, you probably don't care about the details of its fur or the patterns of the grass. You want to know where this tiger is, and more importantly, where it's going next. And the details of the sensory stimuli that might be relevant for inferring the location and the speed of the tiger could be very different than the details that are relevant for identifying its presence in the first place. And so if the environment is changing over time, which stimuli are relevant and for which tasks can also change in time. And so I'm interested in understanding how the brain balances the cost of encoding information with the relevance that this information can have for downstream computations and ultimately behavior. All right, so this is the high-level question that I want to dig into today. I'm going to tell you about a theoretical framework that we're developing for understanding how the brain can navigate this balance in a dynamic way. But I really want you guys to stop me at any point if any of this is unclear, okay? Because I want to work through the details. I don't care how far we get. I want to make sure it's understandable. Yes?
I'm sorry, I missed the first few slides, but, so this is mostly for me to catch up. You see that tuning curve looks like an integral of that Gaussian curve.
Yes.
So what's the interpretation of that?
The interpretation is exactly that. It's the cumulative distribution of that probability distribution. And so you're assigning equal probability to each response level.
Each response. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And so so that's the idea that comes from maximizing information about the stimulus. And so I'm going to argue that we can take this one step further and ask, if we don't care just about maximizing information, but we care about how useful that information might be for doing something else, how can we understand how to extract the right pieces of information to do that something else? Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Are there other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, very high level. So you're looking at the bounded discrimination, so making rational use of bounded discrimination probability. Even higher level is the bounded rationality principle for decision making. And you say you have a cognitive system, you have certain capabilities, you have to make decisions, maybe there's unlimited resources, and you have to trade out the decision making versus utility.
That's the high-level idea. I want to treat this in a dynamic way, where the idea is what might be relevant for these high-level discriminations could actually change in time. So how do you deal with a situation that's changing in time, and how do you use your resources in a dynamic way? Instead of being fixed to some certain distribution, how do you maintain flexibility so that you can adapt to changes in this case, an environment? Is there another question? Okay, all right, so I want to think about how the brain dynamically balances costs and relevance. And to do this, I'm going to think about, I'm going to characterize the environment by what I'll call an environmental state. All right, so in this context, you can think about the environmental state as signaling the presence or absence of this tiger. And I'm going to consider a system whose goal it is to construct an accurate internal estimate of this environmental state. And the idea here is that if the system maintains an accurate estimate, it can use this estimate to guide good behaviors. Now I'm going to use this dotted line here to differentiate things that are in the environment outside of the system from things that are internal to the system. Okay, so everything that sits below the line is internal to the system. Now, this environmental state is signaled by incoming sensory stimuli. So these could be the image patches that I showed you earlier. And these sensory stimuli are encoded in the activity patterns of neurons in the brain. And it's these activity patterns that have to be used to build and update this internal estimate. And so we're interested in understanding how this encoding step here can support this downstream computation. Now the catch here is we're going to assume that neurons have finite capacity of some sort. They have limited dynamic range, spikes are expensive, they only have finite temporal precision. And so we're going to include these types of constraints explicitly in how our neurons can represent incoming stimuli. What this means is that some information is going to be lost. It's not possible to keep all details about incoming sensory signals. Some information has to be filtered out. So the question is, what information should be filtered out and when, if the goal is to construct this accurate estimate? Now, because the environment is changing in time, the system can actually take advantage of this internal estimate and feed it back to this encoding step and use this internal estimate to actually adapt this encoding over time. So we're going to consider a system that has the flexibility to use this estimate to design a smart, adaptive encoding strategy. Yes?
Some people claim that the resource limitation makes us, forces us to use abstract concepts. So that's a kind of taking out an efficient way to get rid of details. So that higher level of abstraction is actually consequences of resource limitation.
That's an idea that we'd like to explore. So can we understand some properties of neural dynamics and even of behavior in terms of making efficient use of these limited resources by basically not wasting those resources on details that aren't important for the task at hand. And so I'm going to try to build in a way to measure importance and how we should think about the relative importance of different stimuli in this case and help let us use that to understand how we should build this encoding step.
Is this like the cocktail party problem? Effectively, where you walk into a noisy room and you change.
You sort of to tune in. Right, so the idea will be, and I'll sketch this out in more detail, and we can think about this in the auditory system, the olfactory system, the visual system, that you receive some incoming signals, but you really want to infer some underlying state, like the source of a person talking. So you hear lots of voices, but what you really care about is honing in on the source of one of those voices. But if you're if you're moving through the room and the source is changing, then how do you flexibly change your game?
In the sense that that's also something that dynamically tunes itself.
That dynamically tunes itself, exactly. And that needs to be flexible in order to deal with the fact that the source is changing. Okay, so this is a slightly less high-level version of the problem, but still fairly complex, and I'm not going to treat this problem at the level of inferring tigers in grass. I'm going to consider a much, much simpler version of this problem to try to gain intuition about this encoding step here. And then I'm going to come back towards the end of the talk and discuss how we can reintroduce some of the complexities of living in a very rich sensory world. Okay, so I'm going to simplify this system, but I'm going to keep track of these key ingredients. And I'm going to give each of these ingredients a state. Right, so I'm going to describe my environmental state by the variable theta. And I'm going to imagine that we live in a world, a very simple world, where the environment can take one of two states. And it switches between these two states at a finite rate. All right, so the environment can be in a low state, theta low, or a high state, theta high. So we can think about this state in the example of the tiger as signaling the presence or absence of the tiger. We could also think of this in a much simpler example as signaling, say, the intensity of light in a room. So we could imagine going from a dark room to a bright room and back to a dark room. Now I'm going to take this environmental state to signal incoming sensory stimuli. And I'm going to use this state to describe either the mean or the variance of a Gaussian stimulus distribution. So in the example of light intensities, we can imagine here these are low photon counts, high photon counts, low photon counts. All right, so here I'm showing you an example where the mean of the stimulus distribution is changing over time. Now, at each point in time, the system receives a single sample from this stimulus distribution. And this symbol, this signal is represented or encoded in this white box. I'll fill in this box in a minute. But we're going to consider an encoder that, again, has some limitations. It has certain constraints on how it can represent incoming stimuli. And I'm going to consider different implementations of these constraints. So in one case, I'm going to imagine that the system can only produce a limited set of discriminable responses. So this step here is analogous, this example here is analogous to the Laughlin case that I sketched out. In a second example, I'm going to imagine a system that has limited temporal resolution, limited finite precision in time. And in a third case, I'm going to consider an encoder that has a limitation on the total amount of activity. But for the majority of the talk, I'm going to focus on this first example here that most closely matches the Lawson example. All right, so here I imagine that we have a limited set of neural responses shown here on the left. And you can think of these again as discriminable firing rates, or here I've shown them as different spike patterns. And so this means that if a continuous signal passes through this encoder, it's mapped onto one of three distinct responses. So we lose the ability to resolve the details of the stimulus, and what we're left with is one spike, two spikes, or three spikes. That's it. All right, so what this looks like in time is if I have a signal passing through, then it will be mapped onto one of these three responses. And it's these responses here that are then used to build and update this internal estimate. Now, if we have a system that can be described by only two states, then we can fully describe the knowledge about this environment with a single number, which is the probability that the environment is in the low state at time t. And in the language of Bayesian inference, this is our called the posterior distribution. All right, so this just tells us the probability that the environment's in the low state given the history of past responses that we've measured. And we can average this probability distribution to construct a point estimate of the environmental state at a particular point in time. All right, so I'm going to denote this by the variable theta hat here on the left, and I get this value by just averaging the probability distribution. All right, so you can think of this as a readout of what the system thinks the environmental state is at a particular time. Now the system can then feed this information back and use it to adapt this encoding step. But instead of feeding back an estimate at time t, we feed back a prediction at time t plus 1. All right, so at time t, it's already too late. The best strategy is to predict what's going to happen next and feed that information back and use it to adapt this encoding step. Okay? So in the end, we really want to understand... yeah?
These prediction setups, what can be the time scale of prediction? And a millisecond, 10 milliseconds?
That's a good question. I don't actually know what the...
Right.
No, and it, you know, this is often treated as a free parameter in a parameter in theoretical studies to say how far into the future can I predict and then tune that window. But what that looks like in specific neurons, I don't know the time scale of that prediction. It's a good question. I'm sure someone else in the room would have a better sense. Yes?
So what you feed back is theta t plus 1, which means that the model is dynamic in a sense, because the estimate of state is just at time t.
That's right. So the way you actually construct this is to, so you have this posterior distribution at time t, and you use this, you combine this information with knowledge of the rate at which the environment is switching. And so you say, I think the environment is in, it's likely to be in this particular state, but there's a probability H that it will switch states at the next time step.
But
so
you need to learn that over time.
Right, so in this case, we assume that it's known. But that's so the system has access to that. But in principle, this is something that you would have to learn, is the hazard rate of the environment. So here, we take it to be known. That's a good point. Other questions? Yeah?
Sorry if I missed it. What the mu again?
What I'm saying here is that the stimulus distribution is described, I'm defining it as a Gaussian, and I'm defining, in this case, the mean of the Gaussian to be theta and the variance to be sigma squared. In a second case, I define the mean of the Gaussian to be mu and the variance to be described by theta.
So these are just two cases?
These are just two different cases. So if we were to have a mean switching stimulus, so you could think of that as intensity changing or a contrast switching stimulus is another example. Great.
What's the step going between adapting the noisy signal to the neural encoding to assign this 3 bits to this according to some rule?
Exactly, and it's that rule that we're going to walk through. How do you actually go about assigning this signal to these spikes in a smart way.
Such that when you do this, when you do another, so basically first you design a rule, then you do an inversion of that rule to reconstruct this curve.
Right, so depending, so in principle you have to decode back out. So you encode the stimulus, decode it, use that decoded stimulus to update your estimate. I'm going to gloss over some of those details, but yes, the full solution involves decoding the stimulus and then using that decoded value to, so you're essentially marginalizing over uncertainty in the incoming stimulus. But you'll notice that because there's this feedback here, any errors that you incur in mapping these stimuli onto responses will be propagated into your estimate. They'll be propagated back to this encoding step. So it becomes really important to choose this step in a smart way so that your errors don't accumulate. Yes?
Just so I understand, if the switching rate is zero, what would the answer be?
If your switching state is zero, in this case, we assume that the system knows that there are two states of the environment. If you could generalize this a bit.
I'm asking a simple question so I understand. If the switching rate is zero, then the state is always either zero or one in the environment. What should the optimal coding rule be in that case?
Right, so then as soon as you know that the environment is in, sorry, let me stop and think for a minute. So if you... if you took the switching rate to zero in this case, there'd be only some very small probability that the environment, well, the probability would be zero that the environment would switch, so you'd have essentially a fixed strategy. So you would not have any adaptation the way we've set it up. You could consider a slightly different version of this where you have only one state of the environment and you're trying to estimate that state, and you could build a dynamic strategy in that way. But here, the system would just be fixed.
If the switching rate is zero, wouldn't it go to the Barlow's efficient coding idea that you showed initially?
It depends. So the answer, the solution to this problem actually depends on the goal that you're trying to solve. And so a difference between what I'm going to set up here and the Laughlin case is what that goal is. And so that will determine the strategy.
You said that the switching rate is known by the algorithm?
That's what we assume, yes. But in general, if you wanted to make this more realistic, the system would have to infer this. It would have to learn this switching rate.
Yeah, but in this case, if it is known, so it should not change its estimate, no?
It should change its estimate by if it thinks that, so if it believes that the environment is in the high state, but there's some probability that it switches at each time.
In the case it's zero probability, like you questioned before, zero from H is zero. So why would the estimate change if the organism knows that it's zero?
Sorry, that's what I'm saying. The system would be, once the hazard rate goes to zero, the system stays fixed.
Yeah.
Right, so you could generalize this to a case where you're actually inferring the value of theta in sort of a more general version of Bayesian inference in the same setup. But in this case, we're treating the case where it's a small but finite hazard rate, so there's always some probability that the environment will switch states. I'm not sure if I've understood and answered your questions to this regard, but okay, yeah.
So just the assumption so far that the organism knows a hazard rate and the rest is just Bayesian updating?
The rest is...
at this point so far.
Yes, at this point so far, the organism knows the hazard rate, it's performing optimal Bayesian inference given this tricky step here. So that's the idea. We basically build on an existing ideal observer model for how to do inference with this simple environment.
It's much better than just taking the average.
It's much then. What do you mean by just taking the average?
I see a noisy signal, and if all you do in the algorithm is taking average, you should, in principle, also infer this underlying. But this is, you're saying first you have to decode in some complicated way which is neurospikes, and then you have to read out this neurospikes in some way.
So the answer to your question depends on the separation between these states. Right. So if the separation is really large, then you can just devote two levels,
local,
right? You can
just local alleys, so some weight, small weight of alleys, get local value. I mean, the idea is getting rid of noise, essentially.
The idea is right, and so we could think of this in two different ways. So we could think of these fluctuations as noise that we don't care about because we only care about the underlying state, or we could think about these as details that we really care about. And I'm actually going to consider both of these strategies and show how they differ. But one of our strategies here can consider this, this strategy number three considers taking a running average of the stimulus. But what you use that running average to do depends on what your goal is. Yeah.
So perhaps that's a really naive question. So the way I see it is you use this kind of updating of your encoding to tell the system what's relevant, what filter to use to extract relevant features. Right, so you're basically changing the filter or the receptive fields with those updates.
That's exactly right.
And
you're using
change it according to some function that estimates the relevancy.
You use this estimate and the prediction that you generate from it to tune your receptive field, to tune your filter, to extract the details that you, in this case, predict to be relevant. So it's all based on an internal prediction, and one of the key ideas is that that internal prediction could be wrong, and sometimes it is. And so the system has to deal with the fact that it's only working with its own internal estimates and not working with the true actual signal, and has to use those estimates as best as possible. And that's what it uses to update this. Does that answer your question?
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Of course. This is great. Keep asking. Okay. So yes.
I have one last question. Does the transfer function at Y at the neural encoding step, does it know anything about the range of X of T? Does it know anything that X could be positive or negative infinity, or that it's bound if it may be bounded?
In this case, X is not bounded. So it only uses the fact that the probability of very large X is going to be very low. But the solution to this problem just relies on dividing up the signal space in a smart way without needing to know anything about it being bounded. But the probability of those large signals will be small. Okay. All right, so we want to understand this encoding step, but it's buried within the rest of this machinery that I've told you about. And so I think it's actually useful to gain intuition about this system by first taking this encoding step out. So I've argued to you that this is what we want to understand, but I'm going to step back, and I'm going to remove this encoding step for a minute, and I'm going to consider the system without this encoding. And then I'm going to make one more simplification. I'm going to take a snapshot of this system at a particular point in time. So I'm going to freeze the system, and I'm going to walk you through how we perform essentially Bayesian inference using this setup at a particular snapshot in time. Okay, so here I'll be looking at fixing time. I'll be looking across the distribution of stimuli. So I'm going to rotate this on its side. And at this particular snapshot in time, the environment is in a particular state, theta. And this state describes the mean of the stimulus distribution. And again, I've told you that we're assuming the stimulus distribution is Gaussian, so we can draw this Gaussian distribution. And I'm going to refer to this as the true stimulus distribution. So this is reality. This is what's actually coming in from outside. This means that the system can receive any number of these stimuli that are drawn from this distribution. All right, now at this particular snapshot, I'm going to assume that the system has a particular estimate, theta hat, and this estimate defines the mean of what I'm going to call the estimated stimulus distribution. Now, because this is an internal estimate, there's some uncertainty associated with this, and so we can visualize this uncertainty by some fuzz in the position, some variability in the position of this estimate. Right? So the system has some uncertainty, and now we can ask, what happens when the system receives a single stimulus from the environment? Okay, so a single stimulus comes in. We see that this stimulus, the particular one that we've drawn, falls all the way here on the edge of this distribution. All right, so the system is expecting to receive stimuli over here, but it receives something way out here in the tail. So we would say that this particular stimulus is very surprising. So the system can then combine this very surprising stimulus with its existing estimate and use this stimulus to update the estimate. And that looks like this. So this leads to a shift in the estimate. And you can see that this single stimulus sample caused a relatively large shift in this estimate from one time point to the next. And so I'm going to refer to this as the impact that this stimulus had on the estimate. So in this case, this particular stimulus sample had a large impact on the estimate because it created a large shift. So now we can look at the impact the different stimuli have as a function of how surprising stimuli are and how uncertain the system is. And so what we see is in cases where stimuli are very surprising and the system is very uncertain, single stimulus can have a very large impact on this estimate. Conversely, if stimuli, if the system is very certain and the stimulus only reinforces this certainty, then it's very hard to actually shift the estimate. It has very little impact. Now, we think this is a more, I've shown you this for a situation in which we're trying to estimate the mean of a Gaussian distribution, but this is a more general property, so we can solve this same type of problem for a range of different distributions where we're interested in estimating either the mean or the variance, and in all of these cases we see a similar property, that incoming stimuli have large impact when they're surprising and when the system is uncertain. Now, the reason that we care about this impact is because it tells us something about the relative importance of different stimuli. Right? So if we have an encoder that can only keep some stimuli and not others, then if we receive a stimulus that doesn't really affect our estimate, then we can afford to filter it out. Right? If a stimulus can really shift, have a large impact on our estimate, then we have to be careful in how we encode and represent that stimulus. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Is this a standard properties of Bayesian?
This is, and we're arguing that this gives us intuition about how we should design this encoding step, that we should really be thinking about surprise and uncertainty in squeezing out bits of information. So this is just to build intuition about which types of stimuli will be very impactful and which will not. Because when we come to our encoding, we'll see that we'll see signatures of this in how the optimal encoding scheme can be designed. Yes, Boris.
Sorry. Just trying to get a little bit more intuition. The business of surprise and uncertainty are somewhat tied together. Right, so, for example, I can have a very uncertain distribution, let's say just uniform over your interval. Right? And
yes.
To some extent, nothing is surprising.
Because there's no tail.
So, what else do I need to, what do I compare the surprise to? I'm missing something, so another descriptor of the distribution. So, you know, there's entropy, which will tell us how uncertain it is. But it sort of seems to me that's not enough,
So that's a good question, and this consideration. So we haven't explored that fully. So to answer your question, all the distributions that we've looked at have some tail. So even something that approximates uniform distribution in some range still has a long tail where stimuli would be surprising. And in this situation, we've independently manipulated the uncertainty and surprise. But in the situation I'm about to tell you about, they're directly linked, so we can't decouple them. These are directly linked in our scenario. But more generally, we think that these are two factors that will affect how we should design an optimal encoding scheme. But it's a good question.
Because he also told us that he defined surprising observation is the one which causes us to revise the estimate. Mm. Right? And my little example, if we just get a single sample, nobody is surprised, but we're not revising the distribution. But if I get a large number of observations at one point, then that's going to be a surprise, right? Because that's when I'm going to revise the distribution, right? So definition really is the sort of revising the distribution.
So here, I've talked about surprise independently of whether or not it shifts this estimate. And I've just shown that for this particular example, when the stimulus does fall on the tail of the distribution, it does have a large shift in this estimate. But I'm not saying that, so that's just to clarify. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
No, I think it's just a surprise. Now, there's a distribution, but there's also a question of how certain you are in that distribution. How many samples there are, right? And
yes.
No single observation is going to move my estimate if I have infinite number of points there, right? So there is some balance.
It certainly, and it takes some time. And that's why if you have if your model is very certain, it's very hard to move it. It takes many samples, as you're saying, before it shifts the estimate. So this is just saying, if I only give you one sample, what would it look like in this plane? But in practice, you know, this is a feedback system, and the estimate will continue to update over time. Did you have a question?
Yeah. So you kind of defined the stimuli that you're getting in terms of mean and variance, but it seems to me here that the big thing that caused a shift is it's an skewness of kurtosis. It's in higher moments that it's taking in the information. So how do you account for that in the Bayesian model? Or am I just looking at this example you have with the Bayesian model?
You're probably looking at my bad job of drawing this Gaussian distribution by hand, extending this tail out. In this case, we just consider consider a Gaussian stimulus distribution without any higher moments. And so if you had higher moments, then that would affect exactly how surprising this estimate would be. So you would what I would expect is that the general properties of this heat map would be the same, but the specific details would vary if you had a distribution that was skewed in a particular way. Yes?
So uncertainty seems to be the variance in the estimate of the mean, right?
It's the uncertainty in the prior distribution.
Okay.
Yes.
But what is the surprise? So how are you defining?
The surprise here is the negative log probability.
Mm-hmm.
The negative log probability of the stimulus. So what would go into the calculation of entropy? So we built up some intuition for this system in the absence of any encoding. And so now I want to reintroduce this encoding, keeping in mind this idea that we should care more about signals that are very surprising or at times when the system is very uncertain. Okay, so we're ready to sort of step back and reintroduce some of the complexities that I removed a few slides ago. So the first thing that I'm going to do is reintroduce the environment dynamics. So just to remind you, the environment can switch now between two different states, a high state and a low state. And now I'm going to reintroduce the idea of this encoding step. And so just to remind you, we can think about this encoding step as representing different discriminable firing rate patterns. And so now we want to understand how the system deals with incoming sensory stimuli. Now, in the case where we have only, so I'm giving you only three response levels, this means that all of these will lose details that differentiate these incoming signals, because some set of them will be mapped onto only a single response. Okay, so just to illustrate this, in this particular example, what this means is that this whole group of stimuli here will all be encoded in the same response value. And this response is then what's used to update this estimate. Okay, so this response can be fed forward and used to shift this estimate at the next time step. And now the system can use this information and feed it back to adjust these response levels. And so what that will look like is a shift in these levels. Okay, so just to show you this dynamically, so the system can feed this information back, and you'll see these levels shift to the left. All right, so what this does is it changes the set of stimuli that are now mapped onto this response. Right, and the system continues in this way. All right, so incoming stimuli are mapped onto a response. This response updates the estimate. A prediction is fed back, used to shift these levels, and this changes how incoming stimuli are represented. Make sense? Okay. So, as we were talking about before, any errors that are introduced in how these stimuli are mapped onto responses and will be propagated back through the system. So it pays to do a good job of choosing these response levels. And so now the question comes, how do we actually go about choosing these response levels? So another way to ask this is, what would the optimal response levels be? And of course, the answer depends on what it is that we're trying to use these responses to do. Okay, what is the goal of the system? So if I tell you that the goal is to infer the underlying state of the environment, then we can write this down as a cost function here that we want to optimize. Right, so in this case, we want to minimize what I'll call the error in inference. I want to minimize the error in our estimate theta hat. Now, if I knew exactly what signal was going to be coming into the system, then I could choose my response levels to be tuned to exactly this stimulus. But of course, I don't know what's going to be coming in. All I have is an internal prediction of what I think will come in. And so the best that the system can do is minimize this error when averaged over this internal prediction. Okay? So we can understand the behavior of this cost function visualizing it. Okay, so if we imagine that the state, that the system has a particular prediction at some point in time, you'll see that the system here predicts that stimuli will be coming in with relatively low values. Then we can ask, how much error do we incur by mapping a stimulus onto a response? And so this error surface looks like this. So regions that you see in dark here correspond to regions of high error. Okay, so the way that you should read this is, if I were to exactly reproduce the stimulus in the response, I'm looking at the diagonal here, and I have zero error. Okay, everything's white. But as soon as I start to misrepresent signals in the tail here, signals that would be surprising, I start to incur really large errors. Now, the task that I'm giving you I give you three response levels, and I ask you to place them on this plane so that they minimize the error. So this means we want to trace these response levels through the white regions of this space so that we have as little error as possible. So this is a geometry problem of sorts. So the optimal response levels look like this. Now, the way to read this is that this whole set of stimuli down here are mapped onto one single response. So there's a flat line here. This second group of stimuli are mapped onto a second response, and a third group of stimuli are mapped onto a third response. And so we can create a compact visualization of this by drawing these dotted boxes that I was showing you earlier, which tell you which set of stimuli are mapped onto a single response. Now, this should start to look a little bit familiar. So if I pull back up the Laughlin example, we can see that this is a very similar conceptual idea to what Laughlin sketched out in his paper, using a limited set of response states to encode the distribution of intensities. So to make this more explicit, so we can represent, again, these response levels in the Laughlin case by this dotted box that tells us which intensities are mapped onto a single response state. Now, ours looks a bit more choppy because instead of 10 levels, we only have 3. But there are other key differences between this scenario and the Laughlin case. So in the Laughlin case, the system was assumed to be optimized based on the true distribution of stimuli in the environment. Here, we assume that the system doesn't have access to the true distribution. It only has access to its internal prediction. That's the best information that it has. And this prediction could be wrong. All right, so that's the first key difference. The second is that this distribution can actually be changing in time. So this, what we can think of as a tuning curve, should also be changing in time. All right, does this connection make sense so far? So to make this a bit more explicit, if we look at the system at another snapshot in time, when the prediction has now shifted here to the right, we see that the response levels look different. Okay, so as the prediction changes, the optimal response levels will also change. And these are response levels that are optimized for inferring the state of the environment. Now in a minute I'll give you some intuition as to exactly why they look this way, but for the moment this is just to say that we can solve this optimization problem, we can get out these response levels. Now this is one possible goal that a system could want to solve, but we could imagine a scenario in which the system doesn't want to infer the state of the environment, but rather wants to reconstruct individual stimuli. So it cares about the details of the stimulus. So we can write this down as a different cost function that minimizes the error between the stimulus and the response. And when we solve this optimization problem, even for the same predictions that I've shown you here, the solutions look different. So you'll see that these predicted distributions look the same as up above, but the response levels here are shifted in different ways. Okay? So the optimal responses depend on the goal, and they vary in time. So now we have all of the pieces that we need to understand this system in a dynamical sense. So I'm going to try to put all of these pieces back into a dynamic setting where the environment is actively changing in time. Yeah.
I don't understand why these are mirrored.
Why? Because I've chosen symmetric. So in this case, the mean is switching between two symmetric values. And so in this case, I've happened to choose predictions that are symmetric. It won't always be the case. This is just because of the choices that I've made for visualizing this. And I'll show you exactly how these span a range of different values in a slide or two. That's a good question. Yeah?
So is that a little like the reconstruction error that happens between different layers in the brain where you have feedback connections, basically reconstructing the stimulus? And
yes, so this is a form here of reconstruction error. And we're trying to differentiate it from the idea of an inference-related error. But the idea is that feedback projections would be useful in either case because they convey information about what's likely to come in, and you need that information whether you're reconstructing the stimulus or inferring some underlying property.
So the input here contains the noise as well? The time to reconstruct the input with the noise?
So in this case, what we would call the noise, what you saw, the noisy fluctuations are actually the signal that you care about. So in this case, the goal is actually to track those local fluctuations in the signal. So we don't think of it as noise, we think of it as an alternate goal that the system could be wanting to solve, is actually track all these small-scale fluctuations.
Theta is still the state, the up-down state of the system.
That's right. And so the idea is if you know the up-down state, you know where to focus your resolution, your tuning curve, because you expect that stimuli are coming in a particular place. So you can really focus your efforts where you predict stimuli to be. So that's why that prediction is actually useful for solving the reconstruction problem.
So the intuition here is that in the top case, you're just kind of putting a lot of you're making one channel just like centered around the zero or the one case, because that's, you just really kind of want to know where it is in general for the full day. And then for the X case, it looks like you have two channels covering each of those states, because you kind of want to get the finer features of the noise around it.
That's exactly right. So what I'll build towards is the idea that in the first case, you actually want to shift your levels to the signals that will be surprising. So these are what fall on the tails of the distribution.
Oh,
in the other case, you don't want to focus on the tails. You want to focus on where stimuli are most likely to occur, because you really care about the details of the stimulus. So how you position those responses is very different for these two strategies, because in one case, you care about all of the details. In the other case, you just want to know if the environment has switched states.
So that second case probably be very sensitive to the hazard rate. The partitions in the second case would be sensitive to the hazard rate?
That's, yeah, and that's something we haven't explored, is across ranges of hazard rates and also across how, as you separate these states, how these results change. So I don't know exactly how sensitive it is to the hazard rate. That's a good question. Did I see another hand? Okay. All right, so we're going to put this back into a dynamic picture. We've been working just with snapshots at particular points in time, and so now I'm going to consider the case where the environment is, environmental state is changing in time, and again, incoming stimuli are drawn from a Gaussian distribution whose mean is centered at this state. Now, this is one particular instantiation of a stimulus trace, but to understand the behavior of the system, it's more useful to think about the statistics of incoming stimuli. So I'm going to, instead of looking at a single stimulus trace, I'm going to represent this by the mean and variance of this stimulus. Okay, so I'm going to draw this as a heat map, and this heat map contains information about where stimuli are likely to occur. Okay, so at any particular point in time, a stimulus is fed into this encoder, which I'll again leave as a black box for the or a white box for the moment, and the output of this encoder is used to build an estimate of this environmental state. Now, if I've done a good job of building this white box that I haven't fleshed out yet, but if I've done a good job about of doing this, then this environmental state here should very closely match this trace of above, and if we overlay these, we see that that's the case. So our system is doing a very good job of tracking changes in this environmental state. So how does it do it? You can dig in, open up the hood here, and look inside this box. And if we track these response levels over time, what we see is that initially these response levels are very stable when the environment is stable. But as soon as the environment switches states, we see a shift in these response levels. Then these re-equilibrate and stay stable until the environment shifts again, and these response levels shift again. So why do these response levels shift in this particular way? To understand that, I think it's most useful to think about these levels in the context of this prediction that's fed back upstream, because it's this prediction that was used to actually optimize these response levels. So if I overlay this prediction, I can represent this as a heat map. This is the predicted stimulus distribution. If this prediction were exactly accurate, it would look identical to this gray distribution. You see that they're very similar, but they're not identical because the prediction does not exactly match the environment. But what you see here is that these response levels are actually shifted away from the mass of this probability distribution. And as this distribution goes up and comes back down, these response levels actually shift away from this probability. Yes?
Let me come back to my question, thankfully. So you need about 5 to 10 samples or something like that. So one sample corresponds to what kind of tax in the brain?
I think it depends on the system. But how many, and even within this study, how many samples it takes depends on exactly how constrained the system is and exactly what the implementation is. So if we vary the details of the implementation, even with the rest of the framework being the same, we see that that time scale actually changes. And so one of the things that we're interested in one of the predictions that we could potentially make is how that time scale could help uncover what the constraints might be. But it depends on the implementation in this particular case. Yeah.
It also seems to be a response time constant in the like the time it takes to update the y responses with the decay time.
It takes some time, it does take some time to update these responses based on this internal prediction. And so I'll show you in a minute snapshots before and after this this switch in the environment. But initially, the system, the environment is switched and the system hasn't yet caught up with it. So it takes a few samples before the prediction becomes accurate again. It takes some time to basically update this prediction. This prediction is what's controlling this encoding step. So because of this feedback, it can slow down the process. Yes?
There's always a lot of discussion how much Bayesian inference in the brain is done. Is it an effective description part, or it's a neural representation which is underlying that? So one could estimate how many actually operations you need, and how many neurons would you need, how many steps to see it.
Absolutely. So there's a long way to go between this and testing some of these predictions in neurons. And so we've considered one particular type of resource limitation, which is in this encoding step. But it, we haven't considered how complex the decoder needs to be to decode the stimulus. If we think about this as a population strategy, how we could distribute this computation across a population. And so some of these are the details that we would need to work out to make really close connection to experiments. But this gives us some idea of principles that might be at play.
So it looks like you can get away with just two gates of coding, in principle, given the signal. So one thing might help, I mean, I don't do this, but for your, to try your optimization algorithm, if you start with n-bit coding, and they should give you a steady state, which is always 2 bits. Is that true? This is what I mean.
So in a minute, I'll show you the results across different numbers of response levels. So a two-bit system can solve this problem.
Yes.
So we can solve this with only two response levels. And what we see is that there's actually a trade-off as you increase the number of response levels. So you can do better and better. You can create a more accurate, this is already a pretty accurate estimate, but you can do...
converge to two or three. You actually need three. Three is just for that whole transition.
You can solve this with two.
Three
decreases the error, but it costs more. And so if we think about this in terms of how many spikes it would take to encode the stimulus, it would cost more spikes. And I can show examples of that if you're interested. But so there is a trade-off between how many spikes you have to use and what the error in this inference would be. And so the question is, how does this, as you increase the number of levels, you basically trade off these two different factors. Okay. Excellent. Any more questions? Okay, so to get into the details a bit more, we can take a snapshot of the system at a particular point in time. So I'm going to look at the system just before a switch, when the environment is stable. Okay, so at this particular yellow time point, I'm taking a cross-section of this distribution here, which is shown up at the top here. And so at this point in time, the environment is in the low state. And if I look at this internal prediction, I would see that the prediction is fairly accurate. The system predicts that the environment is in the low state, which means that these purple and gray distributions almost sit on top of each other. Now, if I look at the optimal response levels, what I see is that, as we were discussing earlier, the resolution, so where I have really narrow response levels and can easily discriminate different stimuli, this is sort of positioned towards the tail of these distributions, of the distribution. Okay, so this says that the system is devoting this region of high discriminability to signals that are predicted to be surprising. Right, so the system tunes these response levels based on its own prediction, but of course, how often these response levels will be used is determined by the true distribution of incoming stimuli. It's determined by the gray distribution, not the purple distribution. Right, so if I now ask, how this gray distribution here is partitioned into these response levels. So here, just as I did with the Laughlin case, I'm going to color these response levels with different colors and ask how much of the probability distribution falls into each of these response levels. Then if I take a histogram of this, what I see is that most of the distribution is concentrated within a single response level. So this means the system is just using one single response to encode incoming stimuli for the most part. All right, so when the system is stable, it can get away with just effectively one response. Now we can ask what happens when the environment switches. So if we look now just after a switch at the red time point here, what we see is that the system hasn't yet updated. So everything in purple should look the same. This purple curve looks the same. These response levels look the same. The only thing that's changed is that this gray distribution has now shifted. So if we play this same trick and ask how this gray distribution is divided up into our response levels, what we see is now our distribution is evenly distributed across these different responses. Okay, so this means that the system is able to discriminate as best as possible with only three levels the stimuli that are indicative of this change in the distribution. Okay. So if we now play a trick where we assign different spike counts to these response levels, so here I'm going to assign 0, 1, and 2 spikes to these different response levels, then I can generate spike rasters based on how these levels actually change in time. Okay, and so the spike raster that I would generate looks like this. And so what you see is that just before a switch in the environment, when the system is stable, the system can get away with using relatively few spikes. Right? Many things are mapped onto silence. But right after the environment switches states, there's a burst in activity that corresponds to using these three different response levels to discriminate these incoming stimuli. Now, this sort of spike raster, generating the spike raster depends on exactly how we map spikes onto response levels, but we can use a more general measure to describe this behavior. So we can compute the information rate that this response conveys.
I'm a little bit confused. Since it's a matrix, afterwards you should just use essentially 2 instead of 0, right?
Say that again?
After you flip the state, shouldn't you essentially always map everything to 2 instead of 0?
So here, the way that it divides up is that you actually use all of these with equal probability, or close to equal probability.
By switching. But after switching, since it's a matrix,
yeah, so that depends on the details of how we've assigned spikes here. So we've used a particular entropy coding scheme in which we assign 0 spikes to the most probable bin. And so it's a way, you would have to form a system that could do that particular mapping. But this is one way that you could map this to spikes. But it's a good point, and it's specific to how we actually, how we did this mapping. But you can describe this more generally using the information rate, and you see a very similar signature. So if we look at the information rate as a function of time, what you see is that just after a switch in the environment, there's a spike in information rate. And if the system then quickly equilibrates, and then if we track this even longer, we see another spike after the second switch in the environment. Okay, so just as a reference, the maximum information rate that a system with three levels could use to encode incoming stimuli is shown by this dotted line up here. Okay, so this is in some sense the capacity of the system, and what you see is that the system is operating well below capacity for a majority of the time, and it only spikes up in information rate when the environment is switching states. And you'll see that these spikes in information rate closely resemble if we were to look at the average firing rate of this spike raster, yes.
Sorry, where'd that max come from?
Oh, this from maximizing the entropy with three response levels. So what it would look like to evenly distribute probability across three response levels, that's what gives you that cap. And so this is operating well below that, and you can understand that because here, for a majority of the time, most of the incoming stimuli are mapped onto a single response. So that's a really, another way to say that is that's a really low entropy distribution, and there's only this spike in entropy when you distribute your signals across these different levels. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is if this environmental state wasn't binary, there's no way you could satisfy this for all different possible changes. It could be uniform for all of them, but maybe it could be as even as possible for all of them or something.
Yeah, so what this looks like when, if you consider a continuous signal space, or even if, so some of the signatures of this are characteristics of the fact that we have a two-state environment, which means that if you're in the low state, you can leverage all of your resources to the high state and vice versa. But even if the state, even if you could move in two different directions, then you'd have to leverage your bits, you know, in a different way, towards the tails, towards either tail. So,
but I still imagine there would be some, like, there would be some way you can maximize the uniformity of these going to either state. Like, can we do it in such a way that it resembles?
And I think, you know, what we're hoping is that this gives us a framework to ask these sorts of questions using more complicated distributions. So this is a way to get a handle on the problem. But now that we have a framework for doing this, the question is, for a system that's not so simple, that's more likely a system might actually encounter, can we solve this problem? And I'll show you some hints that we might be able to move in that direction for more complex stimuli, but it's a work in progress, for sure. Yeah.
Is it not extremely general? So any dynamic system in transition between two states or can have, if you measure some probability distribution function of where the system is, will have a higher entropy in the transition period.
And we think that some aspects of this are incredibly general. And so one of those is that if you're trying to infer changes in the distribution, then you want to be tuned for surprising things. Another way to say this is if you're certain that the environment is here, you don't need to keep updating that model of the environment. You only need to sort of tune your resolution or tune your receptive fields to things that would cause you to update that model. And so we think this is a very general phenomenon and is not constrained by the specifics of this setup. Do I see another hand? Okay. All right, so this is a strategy, again, that's optimized for inferring the underlying state of the environment, but we can compare this to a strategy in which we care about the details of the stimulus. So we want to reconstruct stimulus details. And so again, if we optimize a system to do accurate stimulus reconstruction, we can see how well the estimate tracks this underlying state. And this is shown in green here. I'm not sure if it's clear the difference. The system does slightly worse. It's slightly slower at tracking changes in this distribution because it's not optimized to do so. Okay, so we can understand why this system is slower by, again, looking at how this encoding step is actually optimized. And so here I'm showing you an analogous plot to the one I showed you before. So the green distribution here is the predicted distribution of stimuli. And here you see that these response levels actually hug the region of highest probability. So if we, again, take a snapshot of our system before and after a switch, we see a very different set of responses. So if we look just before a switch, we see that the system is able to discriminate all of these incoming stimuli. So it has an accurate model of the environment. It can use this model to discriminate as best as possible the stimuli that are coming in. But when the environment switches states, over here, we see that its discriminability is misaligned. So it's essentially missing all of these details that are indicative of the change. Okay, so just to restate this, to differentiate these two strategies, in the first case, when optimized for inference, this system devotes high discriminability when the prediction is inaccurate. So when it has a bad model of the environment. And so it tunes its, uses its discriminability to detect signals that are indicative of this change. Right? In this second case, The system devotes high discriminability when the prediction is very accurate, and it uses that accurate prediction to resolve all of the local details of incoming stimuli. Okay, so if we again look at the information rate now produced by the system that's reconstructing individual stimuli, we see that the system maintains very high information rates near the maximum capacity of the system. And when the system, when the environment switches states, we see this large drop in information rate. And this large drop in information rate is what actually slows the system down and inhibits it and, or makes it more difficult to detect these changes. Okay, so we see qualitatively, so the, a take-home point here is that depending on the goal, the strategies look very different. So in one case, you want to devote your discriminability, your resolution, when you have an accurate model of the world. In another case, you want to devote your discriminability when your model is wrong and you need to update it. Okay? Other questions? Yeah.
Difference, isn't there's one more parameter which is the difference in means of theta L and theta H?
Absolutely, absolutely. So this depends on how well separated these states are. So if they're separated enough, you can have a fixed strategy where you just cut a line down the middle. Every time you see a response that's high, you know you're in the high state, and a low response, you know you're in the low state. But here we're considering a system, I've cartoonized it a bit in the diagram, but we're considering a system where there's some overlap between these states. So if you just had a fixed threshold, you wouldn't be able to tell if this is a noisy sample from the low distribution or a sample that's drawn from the high distribution. Does that answer your question?
Yes,
yeah.
Maybe I missed it, but how do you define information rate?
So here, because we have no noise in the system, the information rate is the same as the entropy rate. So this is defined in terms of the distribution of how this distribution is partitioned among our levels. So it's defined by the histograms that were shown up here, that were shown in this spot a minute ago.
So it's in bits?
It's in bits.
Example to define the goal or some loss function, let's say. Doesn't this problem fall into sort of general class of problems that you can write down the Bellman equation for and actually find the optimal strategy for solving the equation?
So exactly how this relates to the Bellman equation is something I'm very interested in. But I don't know the full formal connection to the Bellman equation. But I think there are some interesting ties. So that'd be something I'd be very interested in exploring. Here, it's, you know, this is optimal in the sense that we can solve the particular optimization problem that I laid out, but it assumes, you know, defining a particular cost function and then optimizing the system with respect to that cost function. And so even if we were to choose something like information instead of error, that will slightly change the results. In general,
but the Bellman equation too will depend on what it is that you're optimizing. So it's all, I think, more a matter of sort of parameterizing in some simple but reasonably good way. So the class of strategies, i.e. different encodings.
Yes. That's actually a great segue. So we've explored a set of different encodings, different ways of implementing a constraint on the system and asking how that constraint affects this balance between error and cost in this case. And so I think in two slides I'll show you that the results are very similar across different encoding schemes, but at this point we've considered a small class of schemes that represent different types of limitations: temporal precision, spatial precision, something like thresholding. These types of okay. I'm getting close to the end, so I will try to wrap up. So just to step back a bit, So we can think, again, about this information rate as relating to how many spikes it takes to encode information about the environment. And so we can think about this as a measure of resource use. And we can ask how many resources are needed to solve this particular estimation task. And we can compare this to the error in this estimation task. And so we can measure this error by comparing our estimate with the true state of the environment. This is something we defined earlier. And we can ask how these two different features are balanced within the system. And so if we look at here the inference error on the vertical axis against the information rate on the horizontal axis, we see a trade-off here. And this trade-off is shown across different numbers of response levels. So here at the top, we have two response levels. At the bottom, we have 16. Right? And so what we see is that the system can decrease this error by using more response levels, but this comes at the cost of increased resource use. You have to use more spikes, more information, more energy in order to reduce your error. So this tells us something about the trade-off between the cost of encoding information and the error that that encoding introduces in this estimate. And we see that a system that's designed for optimal inference here in purple achieves lower error in inference. This is to be expected. This is how we design the system. But it does so using lower information rates. So it does it in a cheaper, more efficient way.
This can be computed theoretically, right?
This can be computed, yeah. So rate distortion theory gives you the theoretical minimum here. So it defines a lower bound on how well you can do.
You plotting here simulations, or what?
This here is plotted with simulations. That's right. So this is looking at the average information rate as a function of different response levels versus the error in this curve. It's across many simulations, but it is computed from a simulation. Okay. So stepping back, I've shown you one particular example of an encoding where we represent, we map different incoming stimuli onto a discrete set of responses. But I mentioned that we can consider different implementations of an encoding step, and these all produce similar results. So if we now look at a system that implements a form of temporal filtering and averages different stimuli in time, we see that this system can also accurately track changes in the environmental state. And it does so by changing the degree of correlation or decorrelation between incoming stimuli. So you can think about this as a filter whose time scale changes in time, so the filter expands or contracts in time. We considered a third form of encoding in which the system implements a form of gating. So it's sort of an all or none encoding. Either nothing is encoded or everything is encoded in full. And so here we see, again, similar signatures. Where the system can accurately track changes in the environmental state, and it does so using these, in this case, bursts of activity. So across these many different encoding strategies, we see similar results in terms of the features of this response and how these features enable the system to perform accurate or infer accurate estimates of the environmental state. Okay, so I think I'm going to end by saying that one of the connections that we're trying to make is to think about how this simple system that I've sketched out for you might connect to more realistic settings in which you're trying to, say, infer different textural properties from an image. So instead of switching between these one-dimensional having this one-dimensional signal here, we consider a much more complex visual scene where the goal is to detect whether you're looking at grass or looking at trees. And so we think that we can generalize this setup here to these more complex settings. And we see similar, some signatures of similar qualitative results. in a sort of longer looking effort, we're really interested in pushing this into an active regime. So up till now, the system has been very passive. So it's just receiving stimuli coming in, and it encodes them with an adaptive coding step. But what we'd really like to understand is how this system can then use this internal estimate to guide its actions. And of course, as it guides its own actions, that will change what stimuli come in, will change how the stimuli are encoded, and changes how the animal moves in its environment. So moving this into an active regime is something that we're really excited in exploring, and will enable us to connect with a broader range of behaviors. So with that, I just want to skip ahead a couple slides and thank the people involved. So this is all joint work with a really fantastic postdoc at MIT, Victor Minarski, who's in Josh McDermott's lab. Victor is actually moving to Austria in a little bit to work with Gashper Tkachuk. But we really benefited from a lot of feedback from people at Genelia, John, Vivek, and Isaburo, and the whole computation and theory group. So you guys have been awesome. I loved all the questions. I'd be happy to take more, and thanks for your patience with the time.
Essentially, it hinges very much that the system knows the world, that the hazard rate. Because otherwise, if you don't know that you have to estimate, the world remains in one state, all the green and the blue, it is converged to one.
The system in this case actually has even more knowledge, you know, than just the hazard rate. It knows that the environment is only in two states, and it knows the value of those two states. So the only thing it doesn't know is exactly which of those two states it's in. So in some sense, we've given the system a ton of information. So one of the important next steps will be to basically take that information back out and ask how the system can solve this without knowing all those details. But here, we've essentially given the information, given the system even more information than I. Yes.
It's a very reasonable, very good feedback to estimate the state of the environment and statistics of the environment. How can, in this kind of framework, we can include relevance for behavior? Because some state is completely irrelevant, even though it can be surprising, not surprising, we just can ignore it. And we don't need to use spikes for that. Sounds super. You see the tiger, you do need to kind of transmit extra spike to be sure. So
yes.
How it can be implemented here?
No, that's a great point. So here I've just argued that good behavior relies on having a good estimate, but I haven't told you how to actually take a good estimate of the environment. I haven't told you how to take that estimate and actually use it to choose which behaviors to take. And another important feature is that, as in the case with the tiger, I haven't included any notion of valence, that one state is better or worse than the other, that it might be more valuable.
Valence, whatever it is, kind of. But
right.
Definitely the system does need to distribute spikes. Even if they have the same statistical property from the kind of statistics of the stimuli, but have a very different property from the consequence of the behavior.
One of the things that I'm really interested in understanding is how some of these ideas might relate to ideas that have come up in learning frameworks, like reinforcement learning, where there is a way of assigning valence to or value to different states of the environment or different actions that you might take. And so the idea would be that there you need to use your resources in a way that allows you to gather information about which states are more or less valuable and act on those beliefs in some
sense. I'm saying not acting, but encoding, because a lot of sensory systems are actually built to encode much more relevant signals rather than just statistics for the environment, and the relevance is kind of missing.
And if we were to start to introduce that, then there would need to be feedback about this relevant information to this encoding step. So here the feedback is just about the underlying statistics. But to make this more general, the feedback that you would need to base this encoding on relevance would be something about relative value of different incoming stimuli. So I think it's a really interesting direction. That's one of the things that I'm really hoping to explore with this type of work. But that's exactly the direction you would need to go to actually tie this, I think, to behavior.
Thank you.
Yeah.
As you were saying, here the system only switches between two states, right?
Yeah.
So when you switch, you already know where you're going. And so my question is, do you have an intuition on how this would generalize to a system where you have more than two states, so you need to get information where you are going to transition to, instead of just I'm changing?
Yes, absolutely. So people have, in the absence of encoding, people have solved this problem within the context of Bayesian inference. So how to infer a continuous underlying state, or even a set of discrete states where you have more than two. But there, yeah, here you can really leverage all of your resources to the other state, because it's the only other possibility in the system. If you have many more possibilities, then you have to leverage your resources across these different possibilities. And so, you know, as sort of a very base guess, you would need more than these two or three response levels to solve that type of problem. So the fact that you can solve this with only two response levels is reflective of the fact that this is a relatively simple task. But once you have more possibilities, then you actually need to devote, you know, parts of your tuning curve to different parts of the space. So that's an important direction to move if we want to make this more general. Great question. Yeah.
I think in this theory, the resource, for example, or spiking of neurons, etc. But are there also some significant energy or something that is required to just change the repartitioning itself? Because that could be also quite consuming.
That's a very good point. So there are several stages of this computation that could require energy. So actually shifting these response levels, decoding this, you know, the complexity of the decoder, these types of considerations, we haven't introduced these here. But you're exactly right. If we want to consider the general case of how the system as a whole should use a limited set of resources, then we should think more generally about how those resources are distributed, not just to this encoding step, but across the whole system. And so there, you have sort of a more general optimization problem, where you have a single constraint, but now you have to divide it across the different elements of the system. So I think it's very interesting. We haven't gone any further yet than just thinking about this in the context of the one encoding step. But you're right. Great question. Awesome. Thank you all.